Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 136. Patrick here, CJ Evolution. That's Criminal Justice Evolution. This is a podcast for the criminal justice professional like you, hosted by me, another CJ professional. But we're getting noticed by people outside of the criminal justice field. And that is really good because we like to talk about different topics beyond criminal justice, but we can tie back into the profession. Very excited to have Robert Galinsky on the show today. If you don't know who Robert is, he's an author, speaker, performer who works with incarcerated youth at Rikers Island to motivate them and encourage them to seek a better future and help recidivism. We all know recidivism rates are through the roof. This guy is an inspiration because he's helping these kids, create a better future for themselves. And once they get out, hopefully they can go on to bigger and better things, except, you know, being right back into the system. His work through a program called Literacy for Incarcerated Teens is motivating youth inmates to improve their lives both inside and outside of jail. I give you the one, the only, Robert Galinsky. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. CJ Evolution. Very special guest on today, Robert Galinsky. Robert, are you there, sir?
Yes, sir. Welcome, and thank you for having me, Patrick.
A little backstory. We were having some technical issues earlier, but we're gonna rock this show, Robert. For those of listeners out there who don't know who Robert Galinsky is, sir, can you give us a little bit of background on yourself?
Sure. I was born in Hartford, Connecticut, raised in a suburb of Wethersfield, Connecticut, had a very typical white American suburban background growing up. Moved to New York City last century, 1988, and fell in love with it and have been living in the East Village, Alphabet City of New York City since then, 1988.
Cool. And you are an author, speaker, and you work at Rikers Island, right?
Yeah, I do. I work 2 days a week through a nonprofit called Literacy for Incarcerated Teens. And Literacy for Incarcerated Teens is a great organization, small nonprofit run by retired librarians, excellent people who saw that there was a need to build and maintain libraries, big and small, in youth detention centers because a lot of the kids in these prisons and jails don't have access to good books or to consistent books. Mm. So that's Lit's mission, and through them I have been doing workshops at Rikers Island and a number of other facilities around New York for about the past 4.5 years.
Now, what was specifically, Robert, brought you to Rikers Island? Because you know as well as I do, working in a correctional facility, whether it's adult or juvenile, is very challenging. So what was the catalyst that brought you there?
Well, in general, I love the challenge of working with people who are quote-unquote in the margins. Mm-hmm. So a friend of mine who's also a mentor of mine, Jamal Joseph, who is a Black Panther, was part of the Panther 21, did a number of years in jail for his activism work with the Black Panthers. I noticed one day that he sent a message out to his followers on social media that he was doing a high school commencement speech at a boys' prison secure center in Hudson, New York, called Brookwood. And I was just blown away that, wow, there's a high school graduation in a prison. I thought I knew everything. And then I said, I know Jamal. He's an amazing guy. He's gone from jail to being Columbia University's chairperson of their screenwriting and film program. He's been nominated for an Oscar for a song in the movie August Rush with his theater group. And I thought that takes a special person to be able to talk to young people.
Mm-hmm. Connect with them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I asked him, and he turned me on to Literacy for Incarcerated Teens. And one of my philosophies is say yes, go forward, don't ask, just do, or ask and tell at the same time. So I asked and told. I want to do a workshop through Literacy for Incarcerated Teens, and they said, go ahead, let's give it a shot. And that was about 4.5 years ago, and since then it's blossomed into a lot of my own, programs that I'm developing with the kids, mm-hmm. teenagers, and has become, a very big part of my life.
And I think it's good, Robert, because the recidivism rates, whether we're talking juvenile or adult are through the roof in this country.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so many factors, literacy being one of them. There's proven statistical facts about people who are illiterate, who, you know, you think it's simple, oh, well, you can't read, can't spell, and what the ramifications of that are, not that you just can't fill out an application, but your self-esteem is very low. And when someone's self-esteem is low, then they're more desperate. And when you're more desperate, you do things that are a little bit outside the lines of what's legal sometimes to get ahead.
And I've always, I'm in law enforcement and, you know, but I don't think we spend nearly enough resources on reentry programs and getting people prepared, you know, to go back into society.
No, not at all. I mean, I take a, you know, to get on Rikers, you can either drive with a special pass permit or you get on a city bus and you actually can get on the island through the city bus. And leaving the island, you get on that city bus. There are times where I see, you know, the guy who's been in Rikers for 30 days or 30 months, and what did they give him? They gave him a Metro card with, you know, two rides on it and gave him his clothes back. You know, there he goes. He's left to get out wherever he can, you know, start his life again, his or her life again, and there's nothing really officially waiting for them there. There are tons of organizations that have set up and set up. One of them I work with is brilliant, called GOSO, Getting Out, Staying Out, and they do a great job. But I mean, you've got to somehow get the people who have been incarcerated to know about this, to make the effort to go down there, to connect with these people, these organizations. Whereas if you're getting, as you know, if you're getting out of prison and you've got a parole officer, they make it very clear where you have to report to make sure that you're off drugs, that you're looking for a job, that you're not staying out past your curfew, you're paying your bills. I have a friend who's a federal parole officer, and it's so very strict. It would be nice if there was something set up by those same government agencies to get us back into society and slowly but surely give people the guidance that they need and the resources they need to make their way back in. Mm-hmm. Most of the people that I teach want that. They're not what you see on crime shows on television, where they're, you know, happy-go-lucky criminals, and that's all they want to do. And of course, there's a certain percentage of people that are like that, but the majority I found, majority are people who are, you know, just got terrible circumstances around themselves, bad role models at home and in their neighborhoods, and, you know, just going to get thrown right back into that.
Yeah, and the thing, and again, I'm preaching to the choir, but, you know, it's a lot of times they don't have the means, you know, to get out of, you know, maybe the area or the neighborhood they came from that maybe got them in trouble, like you said, the influences around them. And it's just like this never-ending circle, and it's sad because people, a lot of them want to change, like you said, and I see it on my end too, where a lot of people want to change, especially youth, but they just don't have the means. They don't have the right, you know, people around them to keep them lifted up, and they fall right back into that life.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so I mean, education obviously is important inside to equip, especially juveniles, because, you know, juvenile justice is, you know, the premise behind juvenile system, as you know, Robert, is to rehabilitate. I mean, we want to try to rehabilitate everybody, but, you know, we really want to try to get them when they're younger to kind of turn their life around. But a lot still go back, like we talked about, to the same environment. Is there any other suggestions? I know, you know, throwing money at it is you know, the easy thing, but what else could we be doing to kind of lower these recidivism rates?
One of the things I've noticed in Rikers specifically is that a great percentage of the guards that work with the corrections officers and slash guards that are around the kids, I would say, you know, 50% of them are also trying to mentor and teach the kids. But it's not in their job description, really, to do that. It's not even in their training to do that. So one approach would be, if you're going to train corrections officers in everything they need to know currently, which is really primarily about safety and procedures that are all, you know, bound around safety, which is very important, there could be something added to that where the corrections officers are encouraged and trained to do some kind of social facilitating as well, or some kind of academic facilitating. And I see sometimes where some corrections officers won't do that because they're afraid to create an alliance with the incarcerated youth, and that is looked upon as stepping outside their responsibility set. So maybe realign what the responsibility set is for youth corrections officers. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's also something that includes training for the kids, mentoring for the kids. I go in sometimes and I'll spend 6 or 7 hours there, and there will be, you know, a guard in the room that will be sitting there with his arms crossed and his legs, you know, folded, and just sitting there for 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a human being that has value as well, that corrections officer that has history, that has experience. And if he's given the green light, or she's given the green light and some training to interact with the kids in a way that is more educational as opposed to just supervisional, I think that would be a huge change.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you can maintain that balance between, you know, being there primarily for security and making things, you know, are orderly. But I think you can have a balance, meaning you can do the mentor and you can also do the security. But it takes the right type of people, you know, to do that. You know, again, you just want to have a balance, in my opinion, you know, because, when I go to, like at the jail where I'm at, you know, a lot of these deputies, you know, work, you know, these very, very difficult jobs, but a lot of them have that balance where they're treating the inmates with respect and they mentor them, but they still have that respect as, you know, who they are just by their authority, you know, just by the nature that they're there to protect. And, you know, if things get out of hand, they have to do what they have to do. But I think you can do both.
It's a big shift that has to be done from the top down, where the people who are doing the hiring and the training have to have a really large philosophical change. That is, you're not just here to supervise and for safety. You are here for that. Mm-hmm. And additionally, put more effort into that correction and actually create relationships. There's times where I see guards that have incredible relationships where I can see some of the incarcerated youth trusting these guards and asking their opinion and getting their input on things.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are times, like I said, it's completely the opposite, where it's a cold, very shallow relationship. And I just think it's time wasted. There's if you've got human beings standing next to each other for hours and hours and hours, day after day after day, there's a better way to use that human potential.
And it's money, Robert. I mean, the amount of money that, you know, we spend.
You know, Well, Patrick, I think the money's already being spent. You didn't hear me even say, let's throw more money at that. Mm-hmm. Really, it's training. It's training again. So what is the test I have? Go ahead.
Well, my point is that, you know, maybe if we changed, you know, our system and we changed the way we do something, you know, we wouldn't have these big, huge recidivism rates, going back to what we were talking about before. If we get the right people in there, you're always going to get the people that you maybe just don't connect or don't care or whatever. But maybe that could impact the bottom line, you know, we're not spending hundreds of millions, you know.
Although, you know, I'd love to hear your opinion on this. That's a for-profit system now.
Oh, yeah.
So why would anybody want to change it? There's so, you know, if you have less young people going into prison, then you get to sell less sandals that they have to wear. You sell less uniforms. You have less laundry service. Those companies are all losing money. Food service, they're all losing money. Cleaning services, losing
mm-hmm.
money.
Right.
Health services, you know, right? And I'm not for that, but I don't see the incentive for them to reduce recidivism, because they've set up a system where they're profiting off of it.
Well, I agree. Unfortunately, it comes down to that, and I'm looking at more of the bigger picture, where this is our youth. This is our youth. This is our future. Now, the flip side of that is some of these kids need to be in prison. They need to be incarcerated. Some of them are they're just doing horrible things. But the majority of people, you know, Robert, are going to get out. They're going to get out of prison. It's a misnomer out there. A lot of people think, well, you know, this kid's going to jail or prison, or this adult's going to... Very few people are lifers. They don't go in there for life. So the majority of these kids are going to get out of prison. The majority of adults are going to get out of prison. And I understand, you know, people are making money off of it, but what is the best, you know, the bigger picture, especially with kids? This is our future.
Absolutely.
You know, this is our future. And, you know, I was going to ask you, what are you seeing? What are the main crimes? Drugs, gang activity, the kids that are coming into Rikers?
Just those two things for sure. Gang activity, and then anything related out of gang activity, which is theft, physical violence, you know, assault. I see a lot of kids that are in gangs doing the bidding of the gang leaders, the older guys that send the young kids out to take the risks for them. And yeah, drugs. And what's great is now that the marijuana, the cannabis has been, they've lightened the load on penalties for that. You're seeing less kids coming in for that. But it's the usual stuff, which is just, you know, petty crime, violence, and drug abuse. But a lot of it, you know, we were talking about role models earlier. When your role model is the gangbanger who, you know, is in charge of 20 kids in a territory, that, you know, that's a pretty, for a kid who doesn't have role models at home, that's a pretty appetizing situation, because he's getting rewarded for doing the bidding of these guys who don't get, when people get caught, those guys don't get arrested or accused of the crime. The kids do.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I also feel like, this makes me sound like I'm an ancient dude, but, you know, the video games, every video game that these kids talk about is violence. Has just nothing but nonstop violence, carjacking, shooting, war video games, all that stuff. So if you got a kid who's at home playing 4 or 5 hours of, 6 hours of shoot 'em up, kill 'em, stab 'em, do whatever you can do, and then they are supposed to interact in the real world, you know, their behavior is being modified where violence is accepted, violence is encouraged, violence is rewarded. And I think that's a huge, huge part.
Yeah, I think
of it as well.
Video games, and you know, I agree with you, they've become more violent. But I also think, you know, if you have some good role models in your life, you know, if you have a kid who's, you know, playing those games, you know, I think that you know, if you have those role models, they're not going to succumb to that. You know what I mean?
I can see that, but I feel like the power of these video games, even kids, you know, who have good role models, they're affected by this. They're affected, and whether they go out and commit the crimes, that's one thing. They may not do that, but they're more accepting of that kind of environment and behavior in real life. So there's sort of like, you know, people condoning, or young people condoning that kind of behavior, whether they're, you know, initiating it or not. I think it's a mindset, no doubt. If Grand Theft Auto is one of the number one selling games, and it's about killing, running people over, stabbing people.
Killing cops, yeah.
Killing cops, right? And you go out into the street, even if you don't go and do that, the mentality, you know, you've seen young people who have never been arrested for a crime, probably have never committed a crime, but walk around like they are a badass, right? And it's a mentality that I think is being bred, which is not leading somewhere positive for all of us.
Now, what about some, shifting gears a little bit, Robert, what about some success stories at Rikers? Give us some, because there's got to be successes. I mean, I think there's some, you know, I think it's a huge success what you're doing. And I applaud you for what you're doing, you know, going in there. I don't think a lot of people can do it. We need more people like you, your friend, Jamal. I mean, I really, you know, that is awesome that he's going. He's turned his life around. He's talking to people. He's motivating these kids. What are some success stories out there? I mean, I know that I just gave some successes, but specific successes.
I mean, all right, well, one success story is a kid up in Brookwood that he was sentenced to 30 years in jail. He was 17 years old. 30 years. Now, what kind of positive outlook could that kid have?
Mm-hmm.
And when he turns, I believe, 21, and I was working with him for 2 years, he goes upstate to the big boy's house. You know, now he's going to be with adults. And he told me that he's looking forward to taking advantage of every service that this has to offer him, because when he gets out, he wants to be able to enter society full stride with an associate's or a college degree, some skilled training in different areas. So that, to me, that just his optimistic outlook alone was a success story, that he knew that he could get as much as he could out of jail. Jamal actually told me one of the kids told him that he never would have graduated high school if he hadn't gone to jail.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That is sad.
So, and it's sad, right? It's bittersweet. It's like, wow. But he said, look, if had I not come in here, I wouldn't have woken up. I would not have seen how foolishly I've been acting. And I got my high school degree. Otherwise, I would have been skipping class again like I was before. There's a couple of young ladies that I've stayed in touch with that have gotten out of Rikers. One was in there three times. And the third time when we talked and worked together on the island, she's very clear, I can't come back here. I do not want to come back here again. Mm-hmm. And she, it was hard for her to do. And she came out. She got a couple of crummy jobs that she didn't like. Just doing some retail at a really low-end kind of store that didn't have a lot of respect for its employees, but she stuck it out, and now she's moved. I'm not going to be too specific, but she's moved into a position at a retail of a major chain, and she's on the path to be potentially becoming a manager of a department in that chain. So that's a great thing. Yeah. I got another kid whose own mother is calling the police on him, trying to get him to go back to jail, because when he got out of jail at age 17, he had nowhere to go but back home, and she didn't want him back home, so she's been calling the police on him and trying to get him put back in jail so that she doesn't have the responsibility of having him in the house.
Oh, my God. What is wrong with people, man?
Right. So he's actually figured it out. He talked to his parole officer, and they basically, what he's going to do is he's going to put himself back into a facility for 30 days, and if he does that, then his parole will be reduced and he won't have to live at his mom's house where she doesn't want him, and he won't have to have the same curfew restrictions. So mm-hmm. He's basically saying, all right, you know what, I'll sacrifice 30 more days of freedom by going into this program, which will then release me of some of the bondage and also keep me from having to go back to my mom's where she doesn't want me.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And the flip side is he could have easily said, you know what, screw it, I'm going to go back on I'm going to do, you know, deal drugs or whatever. But he sounds like he wants to change his life. It's crappy that he doesn't have a mom that seems to care about him that much. And he's one of many, probably hundreds of thousands of kids out there.
Well, this is another heartbreaking anecdote. There's another facility out in Long Island for girls. Two of the young ladies that were in one of my classes violated procedure. They were about to get out. They had about a week left, and they violated their procedures at the secure center so that they could spend three more months there, because one of them, when she goes home, her father beats her. Jeez. The other one, when she goes home, her uncle pimps her out as a prostitute. Her uncle does this. And she said, I get three meals a day here. I have my own room here. I have people who care about me here. I'm not going back home.
So they're just reoffending inside.
Reoffended. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, jeez. It's horrible, man. I mean, it's horrible. Yeah, and you know, so many people out there, you know, they don't realize what, you know, especially these kids. Now, again, some of them belong there, but what some of these kids are dealing with on a daily basis, incarcerated, and what they have to deal with when they go home.
Right.
You know, when they get out.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So it's easy to say, oh, that's a bad kid. That kid's, done wrong and terrible, and let's throw the book at him and punish him and not understand the context where they came from. I have to say, this is my off the top of my head, you know, not an official statistic, but I've seen probably 300 young women between Rikers and other facilities, and I'd have to say that if I talked to every one of them, 295 of them were abused by a man sexually or physically. And that has, I'm going to just tell another horror story that a girl told me in Rikers. Mm-hmm. She's been in Rikers for a year and a half. Actually, she got out about 4 months ago. And at the age of seven, her own father would come into her room at night and rape her. And she said he would get drunk. And from the age of 7 to 13, almost every night, he would come in and rape her. She said one night he came in, he was drunk, and somebody yelled something from up on the street. So he leaned out the window to see what it was, and they said they needed some keys. So he threw the keys out the window, and when he did, he slipped and fell out the window. And he landed on a iron fence with the stakes, you know, the pointed stake tips of the iron. Mm-hmm. He landed feet first, and both feet, the poles went directly through his feet. Jeez. And he was suspended there on that fence with his feet impaled.
Mm-hmm.
they took him to the hospital. He spent a few weeks in the hospital. When he got back, he never touched her again.
Interesting. Interesting.
Right. And so now, and she's telling me basically the reason she's in Rikers is she was in a car where a bunch of girls went to go get revenge on some girl. One of the girls in the car had a gun and shot the girl. Mm-hmm. So everybody's, you know how that, you know better than I.
Everybody's
implicated now in that crime, right? So she didn't pull the trigger and she didn't bring the gun, but she was in the car. So now she's facing time. And I'm thinking, with a backstory like that, where your own father, who's supposed to be the guardian and the protector, right, is the one who is violating you every day of your life. Well, I consider that something you have to consider when looking at why this girl got in that car that night, why this girl's misbehaving, you know?
Well, and people like that, just in that particular, I mean, she's going to need, you know, treatment, counseling for the rest of her life.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's, yeah. That's another thing that people don't understand is, you know, a lot of these, you know, they're suffering from PTSD, all kinds of other issues. And even when they get out of jail, they're going to need that constant, you know, therapy for the rest of their life.
Which goes back to what we're talking about with, you know, what do you need for people to successfully reenter society? Mm-hmm. You can't just give them a month's rent and a sandwich, which they don't even do really. Yeah. There's got to be services.
Yeah. And so let's talk about, shift gears a little bit and talk about your one-man theater show, talking about homelessness. Because another thing that you're doing, I think, is great. And what's the homeless issue? I mean, is it as big as it used to be in New York City, Robert, or is it?
It is. It's kind of turning back to back in time a little bit. There was a period of time in here, maybe up till about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, where for a decade you didn't see as many homeless people on the streets. Whether the strategies to get them off the streets were smart or not. You know, when Giuliani was in New York, he did a whole broken windows thing, and he quote unquote cleaned up the streets, but in a way that I felt like was, again, more accusatory than conciliatory. So right now, I think because New York itself is becoming a very hard place to live because everything's so overpriced, and especially apartments and living situations, you're seeing a lot more people out on the street now.
Interesting. People. Yeah.
The play that I wrote was I placed it back in the late 80s. I wrote most of it back then, and when I went to rewrite this and I was going to update it for today, and I looked at a lot of the issues that were in the play from that time, and those issues don't resound the same way. So I said, you know, I'll keep it in that time period. So the play is called The Bench. It's the website is thebenchplay.com, and it's about four homeless guys who are all in love with the same woman, and it's a window into some of the smaller details of what a society, a culture of homeless people is like. Mm-hmm. People look at homeless people as though they're from outer space. They have no backstory.
They just ignore them. They walk right by them.
Yeah. And they have no, not even backstory, but present story as well. Mm-hmm. So what I discovered was I spent a lot of time on the street, cohabitating to a certain degree with these guys and learned a lot about, you know, different systems and how they get their food and where they get their money and how veterans still get veteran checks even though they're homeless out on the street, Social Security, and their feelings for each other and this woman, and also how in the 80s the AIDS crisis and the crack crisis played a huge role in people's behavior and poverty. So kind of takes all those things into account. The thing that I find is most unique about this piece is most one-person shows are monologue with a character and then a blackout, and then a new character monologue, blackout, new character monologue, blackout. My piece is written as though it's five people as a traditional dialogue, as if you had five different actors. Mm-hmm. So I play all the characters talking to each other back and forth, and I think I pull it off pretty good.
That's cool. And it's coming out in October, right?
coming out in October, and three great actors are on my team. Chris Noth and Shabaka Henley, two really great actors, are presenting it, and it's being directed by another amazing New York American actor, J.O. Sanders. So I'm really excited.
Yeah, but and too, it's to educate people about the homelessness. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, everything I do, Patrick, I want it to be entertaining and touching. I want it to blow you away, hopefully.
Sure.
But for me, there's always some kind of message and or window into a world you might not have seen before. So hopefully people leave the theater a little bit more conscious and aware, a little bit more motivated to make some changes in a positive direction.
And it's interesting, but talking about homelessness, I've heard people say before, well, those people are choosing to be homeless. You know, they're yeah. choosing to be out on the street. I mean, maybe, I don't know what your take is, Robert, maybe a percentage of that, but a lot of people just found yeah. themselves in a situation where they couldn't get out of, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And just, in, it's very analogous to prison. It's like, you know, once you get in there, you start to get accustomed to it. You learn the way to operate in there. And when you get out of that situation, you feel less comfortable. It's more, you're almost more comfortable in prison. You almost, some of these people are almost more comfortable on the street in the shelter system than they are in what we call a normal normal situation, a normal community. But I think that's a small percentage in terms of the homeless. I think you know, people, once things bottom out, whether it's because of their health or because of finances, mm-hmm. physical health, mental health, it's not easy to come back. Even when you have support, you have friends, family, and facility to support you. So when you don't have friends and family supporting you, and you don't have a lot of infrastructure supporting you, coming back from that is really difficult.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about National Monologue Slam. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Yeah. So again, yeah. So going back to, like, again, the thread through everything that I do is education. Mm-hmm. And I have found that I have a great filter for watching people present in front of other people and how to upgrade that presentation. And one of the things, you know, I'm the head speaker's coach at TEDx Teen. And one of the things that has taught me is you could have somebody with a great invention. You could have somebody with a great message. But if that person doesn't have the skills to communicate that, mm-hmm. then the rest of the world's at a loss. It's not, we're not able to see how special that message is or invention is. So part of what I do is help people, and I do this with the kids in jail too. You know, when we have conversations, sometimes they think we're just having a conversation, but then I'll do what my friend Gigi Blanchard, who also teaches at Rikers, does, and say, let's helicopter up. Let's helicopter up and look over our conversation and see, how were we talking? How were we dealing with each other? So for me, that's part of conversational literacy when we're talking about literacy. Mm-hmm. And so something like the National Slam is a much more exciting and fun platform. It's actors doing monologues in competition the way singers do songs like on American Idol in competition.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
The Manhattan Monologue Slam is a show my younger brother Philip and I created, and he produces it in New York City. It happens once a month. So we've taken that idea now, and we are making it a national competition and adding the educational element to it. So the National Slam happens, and that's a weekend where people who want to improve their acting skills, their presentation skills, their stage presence, everything, learn the dynamics of how to rock out a great monologue, and mm-hmm. then we set them up to compete with one another for fun in a healthy, positive environment to give them a sense of, you know, put your skills to the test and let's see where they land.
That's awesome. I didn't realize, I mean, I've heard of TEDx before, but I didn't realize there was a TEDx Teen out there.
Yeah, there's TEDx Teen. You know, TEDx allows you to franchise
different sure.
Brands, right? So TEDx Teen is produced by the We Are Family Foundation, which is Nile Rodgers' foundation. Nile's a brilliant music producer and musician. And so, yeah, they happens once a year in New York, once a year in London.
That's awesome. And I know you're involved, Robert, with so many different, what other organizations are you involved in that help children? I know you just talked TEDx Teen. What are some organizations out there that can help kids?
Sure. There's a great organization run by Evelyn Iacolano called Lollipop Theater Company. And Lollipop Theater Company, they screen first-run movies that are in the theaters right now, to children who are critically ill, terminally ill, who can't get out of the hospital room or a hospital bed to go see the movie that's in the theater right now. And it's beautiful because, you know, the sad thing is kids' cousins or brothers and sisters will come in to visit them and say, you know, how you doing, good and this and that and the other. And did you see the new movie, the new Ninja Turtle movie? No, I can't. I'm in this bed. Mm-hmm. So Lollipop Theater cuts all the red tape with the big movie studios to allow them to bring in the films and screen them privately in the rooms with these kids. So there's a sense of normalcy and joy in their lives. It's a great organization. The other organization I work with is the Just Peace Foundation, Maddie Stepanek's foundation, with Dr. Jenny Stepanek. And she's brought a lot of her work into my work at the jails. We just developed a deck of cards because kids in jails love to play cards, mm-hmm. competition. And I'm sitting there watching these guys after 2 years go, man, they've got a deck of cards, which is a great resource. So let's print a book on that deck of cards. So what we did was we took a book that Maddie Stepanek wrote with Jimmy Carter, and it's called Just Peace. And we've taken 26 quotes out of that book, and we are printing them in Spanish and English on the cards, the deck of cards, so that the kids, when they are sitting there alone flipping a card in their cell, will have these inspirational quotes and conversation starters.
That's awesome.
The surface is just too, the real estate on a card is too good to just sit there and have the king with a blade on it. You got to have something else on it.
Oh, and that's such a great idea because, like you said, I mean, those positive affirmations going right back into, you know, what do they say? Idle hands are the devil's work. So if you're behind bars,
exactly.
and they're reading those positive affirmations, they're getting that, you know, pumped into them, which is just, what a great
Absolutely.
Idea. And it's a simple idea, Absolutely. But it's a great idea.
Yeah. We did a crowd fund for it. And my goal was to produce 4,000 decks of cards. I was like, we're going to do one run. We're going to overdo it. We're going to have so many cards that it will never run out. So we've raised, the goal was $9,000 to get 4,000 decks of cards. We've raised $3,000. So I think we're at the end of our fundraising, and so now we're just going to cut down the number of cards that we're going to make, which I guess would, you know, be just over 1,000 decks of cards, which I still think is a huge number, mm-hmm. and those should go into production by the end of this year.
It's really, I mean, Robert, I mean, we just need more people like you, man. Have you always wanted to just give back? I mean, is this something, was there anything in your life that just kind of snapped, or have this always been in you, just like to give back and just to help people?
Patrick, I totally appreciate what you're saying, and I think there are tons of people like
Oh,
me.
I know there are.
Yeah.
But good. What?
When I was, I can just say two things happened. When I was in fourth grade, my mom fell ill, and I had to go to school an hour before everybody else because that was the way my ride could get me there, mm-hmm. in order to get to school. And so what I did was I would go into, there was a pre-K special education program. We were kind of really pioneering at the time. And I would go there and hang out with kids who had disabilities and just loved it, just fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. So from that point on, there was something that attracted me. And then very personally, I had a very rough patch with my father for a period of time in my life. And I was violently, physically abused by him at a certain point. And that taught me a lot because I lived in a beautiful little cul-de-sac in a suburban town with a green lawn, the picket fence, and the birds chirping. But for a period of time in my home, it was really a hell.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that, you know, not everything is what you think you're seeing. You know, because if you walked down my street and you saw me playing in the front yard, you'd think it was great. But nobody knew that inside there was something going on that was tragic. And I think that taught me a lot about not judging people based on their appearances and what my assumptions are, and to dig a little deeper to find out what's going on. And that tied in with the whatever the natural affinity I have for working mm-hmm. with so-called people on the margins.
Yeah. And no matter, everybody carries baggage, Robert, to your point.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we can't just look at people and say, oh, this, you know, this person is, you know, a gangbanger or whatever. Everybody is carrying baggage, you know, treat people with respect because you don't know what people are carrying. Like on the outside, they could have the life, but on the inside, I don't know anybody who doesn't have some baggage. I have baggage. Everybody has baggage.
Yeah. Everybody does.
You know, so you just got to kind of treat people with respect and we all have bad days, but yeah, everybody has stuff that they're dealing with.
And also, Patrick, I just found it so much, life's so much more fun to be nice to people.
Exactly.
Just to, in stride, be nice to people, go out of my way to be nice to people. Mm-hmm. So much more fun and exciting. And I fall into the trap of being a jerk sometimes. And
well, we all do.
And, you know, having an argument when somebody cuts me off or whatever in a car. But for the most part, it's so much more enjoyable the other way around. I also want to say that, like, my relationship with my father turned out to be great because he was a great guy anyway. He had a bad spell in his life where, you know, he was under a lot of pressure and I happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. But maybe, you know, sometimes I think it was the right place. It enlightened me to so much. And so we mended our fences and it definitely informed the way I look at the world.
And it made you stronger, no doubt.
Robert.
I mean, it made you stronger. So if people want to reach out to you, Robert, I mean, how can they find you?
Galinsky Place is my website. Galinsky Coaching is another website. Usually if you Google Robert Galinsky, you'll see a guy with red glasses. That's me. I have people can email me at info@galinskyplace.com. I'm on Facebook. I made a decision a long time ago to be completely morphed into the digital. So there's way too much information about me online and experimental video and audio all over the place. Direct email info@galinskyplace.com.
Well, Robert, I appreciate you, sir. I know you're busy, and thank you. I know I said it a couple times. I'm going to say it again. You're an inspiration. Thank you for what you're doing in the correctional system, and hopefully things will change down the road. But
yeah,
it starts with people like you and many, many others like you doing the work you're doing.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you so much. And you know what? You've got such an incredible sense of empathy, and people a lot of times are, you know, there's so much anti-police rhetoric out there right now. And so if there's more police officers like yourself who are willing to have these conversations, not only have them, but thank you for creating a platform where we can do this kind of a conversation. I think it's incredible, and kudos to you, and you're an inspiration too, friend.
I appreciate it, Robert. Well, take care, my friend. You're welcome back anytime, sir.
Thank you.
All right, Patrick. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.